Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with top economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Colin Camara, who is Professor of Behavioral Finance and Economics at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. Colin and I met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in New Orleans in January 2008, where we spoke about his research program on neuroeconomics. He began by explaining what the field is all about.
So neuroeconomics is, I think, crisply defined as an attempt to create a mechanistic, mathematical, and behavioral basis for economic decision, including hopefully exchange, bargaining, and aggregate behavior, maybe macroeconomic variables. And the key word there is mechanistic. So economics has been extremely successful at positing underlying mathematical structures which can then be linked to behavior, utility functions, beliefs, trade-offs, time discounting, and things like that. And by the way, there's no doubt those will continue to be central constructs for a long, long time. The mechanistic part means asking, does the brain actually carry out computations in ways which are consistent with these familiar theories we've been using a long, long time? I think one thing we'll find out is some of the theories are surprisingly accurate, like there are neurons in the parietal area, a motor area of the brain, that fire at rates which are almost perfectly linear with the expected amount of juice a monkey gets if it moves its eye in a certain direction. So the expected value theory lives in those neurons. Other things we'll learn is that mechanisms that are very common in human brain aren't necessarily producing behavior that's consistent with some standard rationality axioms. Although also, still another thing we'll learn is that novices doing things for the first time and experts doing them with a lot of practice or advice may be generating different brain activity, and the rationality may be, you know, working in different brains or in different parts of people's life cycles. But the focus is on taking very seriously the link between the details of the neural activity, measured maybe very different ways, I'll say more about that in a minute, with a mathematical construct like a risk aversion parameter or the weight you put on somebody else's payoff in bargaining, with observed behavior, typically in experiments for money. So we're really trying to do what experimental economists and others have done for a long time, which is to infer the underlying constructs from choice, but then go further and ask them about the mechanisms that generate the underlying constructs and choice.
So you really came at this out of experimental economics, and then presumably you had to do some retooling yourself in getting up to speed with the latest in brain science.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Talk to neuroscientists about what they're doing.
Yes, exactly. So the neuroeconomics, I think, is part of experimental economics because the tools are experimental, and they're new types of tools typically. Brain imaging is one, but also we study the behavior of patients with damage in certain areas. What they can't do gives you a clue about what that area is necessary for. We're also working with something called TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, that basically temporarily disrupts part of the brain. So if somebody whose brain has had TMS applied suddenly can't really decide how much to bid for things they said they liked and didn't like, that tells you that the dorsolateral prefrontal area is necessary for expressing reasonable dollar valuations for goods. This is a study we're kind of working on. I'm not sure if it'll work that cleanly or not, but so TMS is causal. We're actually trying to use knowledge of what brain areas are being active in different decisions in order to then check the hypothesis by actually moving around behavior, just for scientific purposes. So it's part of experimental economics. In a way, it's part of behavioral economics, in that we're trying to understand more about the psychology and trying to use psychology to inform economic analysis in a formal way. Except the psychology now has to do with is drilling down further into neuroscience. And one thing about the technology is the neuroscientists work at a very large lab scale, and the labs are kind of flexible, almost like small businesses. So unlike in economics, where a typical research project is two or three people collaborating on a couple of things a year, the neuroscience labs often have 10 or 20 or 30 projects going and several postdocs. And so if you can bring them an idea that they think they can get grant money for, and that sort of fits into a very broad theme, at Caltech, my colleagues and I and some others around the world have had a lot of success in getting what we think are top neuroscience people to collaborate and sort of teach. We teach them a little economics, they teach us a little bit about the brain.
So basically what you're doing is you're taking human lab rats and you're getting them to make economic decisions and play economic games, and then you're trying to watch
what's going on in their brains while they're doing that.
That's right.
And so then how do you do that?
Well, the typical experiment, I'll talk about fMRI, although, again, I want to emphasize that even if you wiped out fMRI, there are lots of other tools that measure physiological aspects of behavior, like how much your pupils dilate. That's very closely linked to arousal, which is probably very closely linked to, say, how much you pay for different goods based on perceptions of the products. We also have done a lot of experiments on eye tracking, which basically means we're able to record by looking at your eyes what you're looking at on the screen and also whether your pupils are dilating. So if you think of a core thing in economic decision as acquiring information by studying things and maybe looking at numbers and then expressing valuation in response to what you've seen, those are things we can measure very directly by looking at your eyes. And by the way, very cheaply at the margin. So the equipment costs on the order of $30,000, but once it's there, you can run hundreds and hundreds of subjects. So it's really free at the margin once you invest a little bit in the skills of how to analyze the data. And anyway, anyone who wants to do poor person's neuroscience or cognitive neuroscience, eye tracking is a very simple thing to do. Anyway, so in fMRI, one key thing about fMRI and all these studies, eye tracking too, is that basically anything you can put on a computer screen that represents a decision can be the stimulus. So when people are in the fMRI scanner, it's the exact same scanner used to do medical MR scanning to see if you have tumors in the brain or something like that. They lie in the scanner, they slide back in. It is claustrophobic and loud. We give them headphones. Also, we ask them not to move their head too much because we're trying to identify small parts of the brain, and head movement makes that difficult to do. Otherwise, what they see is, in a pair of goggles, they see a computer screen. So anything you can put on a computer screen can be something they're attending to in fMRI, and then they have a button box which allows them to enter in prices or yes, no, or left-right type choices. So in theory, for example, you could have people sitting in the scanner looking at election returns happening in real time or a stream of foreign exchange trading prices, you know, the things that are real basic economic activity. The fact that they're lying in the scanner is interesting scientifically, but what they see on the screen is something you can put in any other type of screen. That means you can do experiments on lots and lots of things.
So what kinds of things are we learning? I mean, there must be some surprising things you're learning about people's decision-making and being able to analyze it in this depth, going right into their brains.
Yeah. So as I said before, one class of findings is that for really, I would say, fairly simple economic decisions that have been very well sculpted by evolutionary processes. So those are things that involve, say, food, sex, and danger. Simple principles of trade-off and valuation are showing up in the brain in both monkeys and humans, even at the level of a single neuron firing. So there's a remarkable study by Padua-Shiopa on monkeys looking at different types of juice, and he finds neurons in the orbital frontal cortex, that's above the eye sockets in the front of the brain, just above the eyebrows, which fire in response not just to what you've chosen, but to an imputed utility value. These are things that are not saying, oh, red juice is good or bad juice. It's good at saying, I picked good juice and it's firing this much. So some basic elements of utility maximization are there, which is kind of shocking, perhaps. But so far, mostly for simple types of tasks, which, as I said, evolution has probably had a long chance to sculpt, you know, choosing between different rewards. And also in the monkey experiments, animals often do these things hundreds and hundreds of times, so they're very highly, they're essentially expert shoppers for the things that they're doing. Another thing we'll find out is that some constructs in behavioral economics, which we think proved to be useful both in explaining experimental results and also increasingly in explaining field data on stock returns and house price movements and consumer pricing, will show up in the brain in certain ways. So one example is prospect theory, which is from a psychological viewpoint, actually, it's kind of a modest modification of expected utility in which you assume that people care about variations of outcomes from a point of reference rather than something like a final wealth position. And also probabilities of very low events may be highly overweighted because of something like perceptual availability or, you know, I think I'll win the lottery, optimism. And so far, the three main elements of prospect theory, which is a kind of reflection effect. If a choice is described as choosing among possible wins, people are a little averse to risk. If the same choice is described as avoiding possible losses, people are often risk seeking. That is, they'll take a gamble where they might lose more in order to be able to break even. You see this in real life gambling behavior sometimes too. That's been found evidence of that has been found in fMRI. There's also evidence for loss aversion. That's a kind of exaggerated hedonic reaction to loss relative to gain, dollar for dollar. We also have a study where you can move around loss aversion by telling people to think about losses, think like a trader, and imagine that if you have losses, they cancel them with gains. That actually changes brain activity in the amygdala. It changes the amount of sweating they do, skin conductance, which is a measure of arousal, and it changes their loss aversion parameter as we had measured in a very conventional econometric way by just taking choices and saying what value of loss to gain seems to explain what they picked. So things are lining up very nicely. And the final piece is weighting of probabilities, and there's some evidence. These are all essentially one study and very much in flux. But so far, the early returns look like the pieces of prospect theory there in the brain. Another area that people have been studying quite a bit is social valuation, social reward compared to private reward. So the self-interest hypothesis is a kind of well-beaten straw man in economic analysis and is certainly useful for many, many types of applications. But in many types of exchange and even aggregate decisions like maybe voting on tax policy to redistribute income, people clearly have some constellation of attitudes about fairness and inequity and trust which are affecting economic behavior. And the imaging studies have shown, about six or eight studies now have shown, that people's internal brain reactions to the reward other people get are occurring in similar regions to getting money for themselves, which suggests a natural hypothesis that own reward and then some social component of reward are being traded off in some way that probably will be well characterized by some variant of utility theory in which people have utility for what others get or what others think of them or something of that type.
So it sounds like there are some potential applications for this research program outside of the academic world. I mean, is your work being picked up on and thought about and used? Or?
Well, unfortunately, it's often picked up on prematurely. It hasn't been used very much, at least the things we've been doing. Partly because many of the papers come out in very broad journals and they're more widely reported by science writers than, say, typical economic studies often are. You hear from clinicians all over, and there's a number of people marketing or interested in finding, you know, buying areas of the brain and things like that. I think so. I would be, and I think almost all my colleagues are still rather cautious, unless it's making money, about making big claims about applications. But I do think the applications are often just one or two steps away from the science. For example, the TMS, a magnetic disruption I referred to earlier, is being widely used in trials to treat depression and things like that. The idea is that there are areas of the brain, the subgenual cortex, that may be insufficiently active, and that's somehow linked to depression. And if you juice those areas up, people are less depressed. So those kinds of applications are proceeding very, very fast. Also, compared to academic economics research, which has a life cycle on the scale of years, you know, from the idea to gathering some data to getting it published, the pace of accumulation of knowledge is very fast in neuroscience. It's something much more like, from idea to finished product might be 6 months rather than 2 or 3 years. And the journal process also works very quickly. And the journals are actually, Science and Nature, for example, are very competitive to get the latest, neatest findings out. And that I think the cycle time is sort of 2 or 3 times as fast. That means also there's a big bonus to exploration. So people are trying a lot of things. The things that seem to work will get tried by lots of other people, we'll quickly find out. And applications, you know, hopefully good applications will come reasonably quickly, and misguided applications will get weeded out faster too.
And where are you going next with the research program, and you and your colleagues, and are you sort of gathering wider interest within the economics profession as well as amongst the scientists?
I think so. I think the biggest participation will probably not be economists. Economists will mostly be consumers. I think. And it may be that the comparative advantage of most economists, given the way graduate training works and the practical questions people are interested in, will be kind of consuming findings that people like me produce and also lots of neuroscientists and cognitive psychologists produce, and then constructing theory around that. And by the way, most neuroscientists we talk to would love to have more formal structure to combine, you know, how is an emotional or cognitive aspect of the brain combining, or how does the orbital frontal cortex and the parietal region and the amygdala all collaborate to detect whether something's a threat and then rapidly suppress a response, etc. So they have much less of a natural instinct of mathematically formalizing how things are working. And that may be the big export from economic theory into neuroscience. So I think the amount of data production coming from collaborations with economists will, in the short run, not be that great. I would say they're about, of people like myself who are senior professors who can, this is what tenure is for, you know, who, thanks to tenure, can do something very exploratory and wild and get well supported to be able to do it at a good scale. There may be 10 or 15 professors kind of working on things actively. We don't see very many grad students in economics jumping in. We have a few at Caltech. So far, the job market for them has been pretty good as well. I think economists will be more like consumers, but there'll also be a certain amount of implicit and collaboration in the form of economic theories suggesting experiments to do. Neuroscientists will often do them. The data will get fed back into the way theorists think about time preference, for example, and debates about self-control. And then many of those topics are really just a step away, I think, from, if you think about the central things in economics, one is people's taste for risk and actions in the face of uncertainty. That has a lot to do with investment in emerging markets and possibly macroeconomic business cycles that involve animal spirits and sort of consumer confidence. One of the most immediate areas of application might have to do with self-control, temptation, addiction. Those are topics which are very right, because there's a long pedigree of careful mathematical formalism guiding you to think about what discount functions might look like. The animal model, that is, doing similar experiments in animals as you would to humans, is extremely useful. An important fact, for example, is that rats become biologically addicted to all substances that humans do. So that's part of why drug addiction research has really boomed, and we know a lot about human addiction from the rats. And also, regulators and policymakers are very interested in what these new ideas could tell us about a scientifically grounded scope for regulation. And I should hasten to add that that doesn't mean more regulation. It might actually mean less regulation. It might mean, for example, in deciding ages of consent for teenagers consenting to drink alcohol or have sex or drive cars or vote or join the military, that, you know, developments in adolescent brains will give us a much better template than we currently have, which is often guided by historical tradition and religion and all kinds of other ad hoc things. And similarly with consumer protection and so forth. I guess finally I should add that I think economics will do fine without neuroscience. It just will give it sort of a turbo boost, and in some cases may be a very efficient method to sort out debates about different kinds of theories that have been going on for a very long time, like the nature of self-control and how that works in the brain and how it develops across the life cycle and what a regulator might do to enhance self-control, or whether private markets can supply it perfectly well.
Colin Cameron, many thanks.
My pleasure.